From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Leon Dash, who describes himself as an African-American journalist alarmed by the growth of the black underclass. His new book, Rosalie, examines the connections among racism, poverty, drug use, and crime by focusing on the story of one woman and her family. The book is based on his Pulitzer Prize-winning series in The Washington Post. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews some of the best and worst shows of the new season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A new report on the terrorist attack that killed 19 U.S. Air Force personnel in Saudi Arabia this summer concludes that the Pentagon and a key field commander must share the blame for the incident. The report says the Pentagon failed to provide guidance or standards for protecting U.S. forces, so inadequate State Department guidelines were used instead. As a result, the report says thousands of U.S. servicemen living in an urban apartment complex near Dahran were vulnerable. The report also faults Air Force Brigadier General Terry Schwalier, saying that he failed to heed clear warnings of possible terrorist attacks against the housing complex. The report was prepared by a task force headed by retired Army General Wayne Downing. Ballots from this weekend's elections in Bosnia are still being tallied. International observers say preliminary results may be available later today. Nationalist parties are expected to do well on all sides, but it's not yet clear who will lead the new government. From Sarajevo, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
Elections in Bosnia are a lot like a census. Ideology can be irrelevant. The election results mainly show how many of each ethnic group live where. According to pre-election surveys, Serbs, Muslims, and Croats were all inclined to vote for their respective nationalist parties. The big question is whether Muslims outvoted Serbs or vice versa. Many Muslims who'd been expelled from what is now the Serb Republic in Bosnia chose to vote in their old hometowns, either by absentee ballot or in person. But there were no Muslim presidential candidates on the Serb ballot. Serb voters generally stuck together inside the Serb Republic. This could give them an edge in the presidential balloting. Under the Bosnia peace agreement, the country will be governed by a collective presidency with three members, a Serb, a Muslim, and a Croat. Whoever gets the most votes will be the chairman. I'm Tom Jelton in Sarajevo.
The United Auto Workers Union and the Ford Motor Company have resumed bargaining in Dearborn, Michigan. They took last night off to rest after a weekend of marathon talks. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The deadline for reaching an agreement passed over the weekend, but the UAW has told its members at Ford plants across the country to keep working, that so far a strike is not necessary. The two sides are believed to be wrestling with the question of job security. The UAW wants Ford to guarantee employment levels for the life of the new contract, the thinking being that if the company has guaranteed jobs for its current workforce, then it will be less likely to farm work out to non-union outside suppliers. While talks continue at Ford, the Canadian Auto Workers Union is bargaining with Chrysler in Toronto. There, the tone is more acrimonious, with union leaders saying a strike is increasingly likely in Canada, perhaps as early as Wednesday. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 33.5 points at 5,872 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 6.5 points. This is NPR News. President Clinton says the U.S. has not been seeking a confrontation with Iraq, but he declined to say whether that means he will forego any further missile attacks against Iraqi targets. Mr. Clinton says his concern is that the U.S. limits Saddam Hussein's ability to threaten his neighbors and that we keep our pilots safe. Divers are back in the water hunting for wreckage of the TWA crash off Long Island, New York. They had been kept on shore for several days because of the effects of Hurricane Hortense in the region. The divers are today searching an area where most of the fuselage of the plane is believed to be located. A Canadian political leader says continuing disputes over how to manage Pacific salmon stocks could lead to the extinction of some salmon species within the next decade. From member station KPLU, Steve Kruger reports.
British Columbia's socialist premier, Glenn Clark, says the Canadian fishing industry has made major sacrifices to protect Pacific salmon, while American politicians have allowed the U.S. industry to continue overfishing. The Canadian government is in the process of buying out about half of that nation's fishing fleet in an effort to reduce the pressure on salmon stocks. Clark told a forum on sustainable fisheries in Seattle that several species, including the Chinook, are close to extinction. He outlined a 6-point plan to manage the remaining salmon populations, including a preservation plan and a new system to settle disputes over catch limits. The Pacific Salmon Fisheries Commission is to discuss Clark's plan later this fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Kruger in Seattle.
NASA engineers say the space shuttle Atlantis will be able to rendezvous and dock with the Russian space station Mir despite an equipment problem. One of the shuttle's three hydraulic power units shut down prematurely after launch. The docking is scheduled for Wednesday. Atlantis will pick up astronaut Shannon Lucid, who has been in orbit aboard Mir since the spring. Astronaut John Blaha will replace Lucid on Mir. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leon Dash describes himself as a black journalist alarmed by the growing black underclass, trapped in urban poverty, filling America's prisons, and shooting each other on the street rather than finishing high school. Dash has devoted much of his career to exploring the creation and growth of the black urban underclass. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1994 Washington Post series about a woman named Rosa Lee and her family. He used her life to trace the interrelationships among racism, poverty, illiteracy, drug use, and crime, and to see why these problems sometimes persist from generation to generation. He expanded the series into a new book called Rosa Lee. Rosa Lee died of AIDS before the book was completed. Dash's earlier book, When Children Want Children, was about adolescent pregnancy. Leon Dash told me how he first met Rosa Lee.
Well, Rosalie, when I met her, was a 51-year-old woman I had met in the D.C. jail. She was among 40 inmates that I was interviewing for this project, all of whom had the characteristics of underclass life. Three generations in deep poverty, three generations of welfare dependents, raised by in a single female household, long histories of criminal deviancy. And this is all part of a definition of who fits into the underclass that was put together by the Urban Institute. And she certainly did. Rosa Lee had 8 children by 6 different men, and 6 of her children had followed her into a life of drug addiction and criminal deviancy and criminal recidivism, cycling in and out of prison constantly. And 2 of her 6 sons had not. One of them moved into the middle class and one moved into the working class, and disassociated themselves from the criminal activities of the entire family.
So by looking at Rosa Lee's story, you hope to understand what?
Well, the perpetuation of poverty and criminal deviancy and drug addiction, the vulnerability of drug addiction among the poor, what the survival tactics were, why those tactics were the antithesis of what the middle class in this society considers conventional lifestyles, and how this all began. What were the antecedents? What were Rosalie's parents like? What were her grandparents like? What deficiencies existed before Rosalie was even born in 1936 that sort of foreordained that she would end up in the underclass? Those were the things that I was looking for.
Let's look a little bit at Rosalie's life. She supported herself while raising her 8 children by shoplifting and sometimes by selling drugs. She used drugs throughout. Now, not only didn't she protect her children from drugs and prostitution, she initiated them, which is really a tragic thing. I mean, tell the story of how she used her granddaughter to hide drugs.
Well, she I wanted to clear up one thing to me that was significant in her life,
mm-hmm.
is that she sold heroin for 19 years before she ever used it.
Mm-hmm.
She first used heroin when she was 39 years old in 1975, and her daughter, she had suffered the breakup of a lesbian relationship that had been going on for 3 years. And her lover moved out. She was despondent about that emotionally, and her oldest daughter, Patty Cunningham, suggested that she take a hit of heroin so that she could get over the emotional pain of the breakup. And Rosalie did and liked the results, and then from there on became a heroin addict. So she started her heroin use very late in life, at 39. Generally, that's something people begin in their adolescence. I just wanted to make that point. Her five-year-old granddaughter, Rosalie, was dealing drugs, really, at this point in the summer of 1988. She had just been released from jail in May of 1988. She and that granddaughter were living in a shelter, a homeless shelter. The mother of the daughter, Rosalie's youngest daughter, was in jail at the time on a drug conviction. And Rosalie didn't have a welfare check at the time. She had initiated the paperwork to get the welfare check. And she was doing what she knew how to do best. She was dealing drugs in a market that was not too far from the shelter at the corner of 14th and W Streets, and also babysitting her five-year-old granddaughter. So she decided that since the last time she was arrested, the policeman arrested her and she had to spend 9 months in prison because they found drugs on her person, she decided to use the granddaughter as a courier. And to keep the drugs off herself, she had the drugs hidden in a piece of the sidewalk that was broken. And when a customer would come up to her to buy drugs, she would give a certain hand sign to her granddaughter. And then the granddaughter would go and retrieve the heroin from this hole in the sidewalk and then return and hand the drugs directly to Rosa, her grandmother's customer, to Rosalie. And Rosalie then only handled the money. And she said to me, I said, well, what would have been your motivation to do that? She said, well, I figured that they wouldn't search a five-year-old child, the police, if they came into the drug market. And if they searched me, they wouldn't find any drugs on me.
Another example of that, Rosalie initiated one of her daughters into prostitution. She asked her daughter to have sex with a trick for money.
Exactly, and the daughter was 11 years old at the time. That's Patty, the oldest girl. Patty had already been sexually abused by two older male relatives from the age of 8. And when I say sexually abused, I mean raped repeatedly. And one day a trick came by. Rosalie by this time was a prostitute. She had started prostituting after her last daughter was born in 1963. And on this particular day, in 1969, when Patty was 11, her oldest daughter, the male trick, an adult male, a man in his 40s, asked Rosalie, could he have sex with Patty? And he would pay more. And so then Rosalie went to Patty and asked her, would she be willing? And Patty said, yes, if it helps you, if it helps you feed us. Meaning herself and the other 7 children. And so then she had sex with the man, and the man paid substantially more than he was accustomed to paying Rosalie. And then thereon, Rosalie prostituted Patty with adult men, generally on weekends.
Did you talk to the daughter, Patty, about the impact of this on her life?
Yeah, I first met Patty in a what is called an oil joint, which is a heroin den where addicts go to shoot up heroin. But Rosalie took me into the oil joint to meet Patty. And that was in May, shortly after Rosalie got out of jail in May of 1988. And Patty was so high on heroin that I could see that we couldn't hold a conversation. And Rosalie told me you'd have to meet Patty some other day when she's not so high. The following month, in June of 88, she was arrested and for running an illegal establishment. She had some New York City crack dealers operating out of her apartment, and they were paying her $50 in crack and $50 in cash each day in order to rent her apartment. So she was charged with running an illegal establishment, and I went into the D.C. jail to see her for the first time when she was not high on drugs. And she was in jail for about 4 months, so I went in and out of the jail doing interviews with her while she was in the jail. And those were my initial interviews with her. And in the second interview, she told me about the sexual abuse that she had suffered, both from two older males in her family, and her mother prostituting her when she was a child. The interview itself was so tense, and she had such a need to release this information that I ended up leaving with a splitting headache with all the details she had told me about the sexual abuse and the and Rosalie prostituting her. And in fact, when the original series ran in 1994, September of 1994, on the fourth day of an eight-part series, Patty called me from prison. She was back in prison. And she had been following the series, and people at the prison that she doesn't read very well, she never went past the fourth grade, but people at the prison were reading the series to her. And she called me to say that I had not gotten into the details of how she was sexually abused as a child, and which was really, from her point of view, the rationale for her substantial amount of drug use. She felt that she had to anesthetize herself because she had never gotten any help in dealing with that emotional pain from her childhood. And I said, Patty, that will be on the sixth day of the series. You just have to be patient. And she said, okay, fine, just as long as you tell people why I am the way I am.
Was she angry with her mother for bringing her into prostitution?
The way Patty put it, she was ambivalent about her relationship with her mother. She both hated her mother and she loved her mother. And she, ironically, was the of the eight children, the child that Rosalie favored and the child that was closest to Rosalie throughout Rosalie's life. Rosalie died in 1995 of AIDS. But Patty, her oldest daughter, the daughter that she prostituted, was also the child that was closest to her. And Patty always explained this duality in their relationship from Patty's perspective, that she both hated her mother and loved her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leon Dash, and his new book, Rosalie, A Mother and Her Family in Urban America, is based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning series he wrote for The Washington Post. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leon Dash, and in 1994 he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning story about a woman named Rosalie, who he describes as being a member of the underclass. And to understand more about how people get into and how generations stay in the underclass, he investigated her story, wrote a series about her story. It won a Pulitzer Prize. That series has now been expanded into a book called Rosalie. Your previous book was about young teenagers who have children. Rosalie became a mother at the age of 14 and went on to have seven other children. Her eight children were fathered by six different men. Did you talk with her about whether she wanted to have that many children and whether she ever considered using birth control?
Right. At one point, we had visited where her parents and grandparents had migrated from, a little plantation called the Bishop Powell Plantation in Northampton County, North Carolina, not too far from the hamlet of Rich Square, North Carolina. And we were talking about the expression that's used down there by the women, that they talk about the number of children they've given birth to, whether the children lived or didn't live, because there was a lot of infant mortality. But the expression they used was that I owned six or seven children, or I owned nine children. And Rosalie's mother had 22 children, 12 of whom lived to adulthood. And Rosalie herself had eight. And she explained to me that when she was growing up, even in her household in Washington, her mother and her mother's friends and mother's relatives talked in that way in terms of the number of children they owned, bragging about the number of children that they had had. And Rosalie felt very early on, long before she was a teenager, that having a large number of children was a very important thing to do. And it established that you were a woman. What happened was that she, because of her dark-skinned complexion, she felt at a disadvantage with light-skinned black girls in terms of attracting boys. But at a particular party, a light-skinned boy took a special interest in her, and she felt the envy of the other girls because of his interest in her. And she decided that she would try to hold on to him using sex to hold on to him, because she didn't think her looks would be able to hold on to him. And they had sex twice. She got pregnant, and she never saw him again. She later told me that when we first met, she told me that her mother had never explained to her about human sexuality and how children are produced. And that's why she had eight children. And my response, and I was laughing at the time, and I said, Rose, you can use that rationale for the first child, but not for the other seven. And she laughed too. And then she went on to explain to me how important children were in the world that she had grown up in, a world that had been transported out of the sharecropping background that her parents and grandparents came to Washington with. And a world, and that old sharecropping culture where children were very important to the sharecropper's survival, because they were an implicit part of the sharecropping contract with landowners.
Let me ask you a sensitive question. Do you buy her explanation for that, or do you think that she just didn't bother with birth control and things happened and then she had to figure out a rationalization for why they happened?
No, because she tried to present the rationalization of ignorance about human sexuality as the reason why she had eight children. And it was only from my research with adolescents in terms of understanding that there are generally deep-seated motivations for anyone, that, and the motivations are emotional. The motivations are not necessarily logical. That the deep-seated emotional basis and cultural basis had more of an overriding factor on why she had eight children than anything that you could see in the contemporary urban landscape.
How many of Rosalie's children became teenage parents?
All except the boy that was gay, the oldest son. Bobby was gay. He died of AIDS in January of 1994. But all of her children were teenage parents, and all of them had done it for motivations of feeling to, of becoming adults. The rationale, when you broke it all down in conversations with them, is that they didn't feel grown until they had had children. Patty had her first child at the age of 14 in October of 1972. And she then on, thereafter, she had two pregnancies that she aborted. And when I asked her why, she said she, I said, Patty, why did you abort the subsequent two pregnancies? And she said, well, I was already a woman. I had had my child at 14. I didn't need any more children to show that I was a woman. So it was very clear. The motivation for having children is to establish, to move, it's a rite of passage from adolescence to adulthood. Eric, Rosalie's, one of Rosalie's two sons who never got into drugs and never got into crime, dropped out of junior high school at age 14 after his son was born. And his his position was that he didn't want to be around these kids in junior high school. He was now a man. He had a son. He had to get out and work to support his child.
You describe Rosalie's life as a daily life of one crisis after another. I'd like you to give just a set of examples of that, and I'm wondering if you think that that's typical of people in the inner city who are as poor as she is and have turned to crime and drugs as a way out of that poverty.
Well, I want to be clear. People say in the inner city, they use a lot of generalities in terms of people in poverty and deep poverty. Not everybody who is in poverty is a member of the underclass. The underclass is a separate group apart from the working poor and even people who depend periodically on welfare. The underclass is separate from them in terms of the dependence on welfare and the criminal deviancy and the criminal recidivism going in and out of prison, generally not for violent crimes, surprisingly, but a lot of property crimes. But in terms of the crisis, when you have three generations of drug use and drug sales going on in one family, there is always a lot of chaos. There isn't a lot of attention to detail. There isn't a lot of paying bills on time or paying bills completely at all. And I noticed that early on that all of Rosalie's children, when they were not in jail and they were living with her, relied on her to run the household. And she really didn't have the skills to run the household correctly. She'd never had the skills, and there had always been chaos in the family's life, even when the children were very small. Rosalie could not read. She had gone up to the seventh grade in the D.C. public school system, but was illiterate. She had never been, and it wasn't anything slow or retarded about her, she just had never been taught to read. And so as a consequence, she could never understand all of the bills that arrived. But in basic bills, I'm talking about electricity and the phone bill. And she always paid part of those bills because so much of her income, particularly the welfare check, went to drugs immediately after the welfare check arrived at the first of the month. And so the phone was always cut off, periodically cut off. Sometimes electricity was cut off for 3 and 4 months at a time until she could build up enough money to pay off the back bill and then make a deposit on the future. And with that, you had to accept that there was always going to be a lot of conflict in the household, and particularly over drugs and money. Rosalie, for example, would hide her money on her person, usually in her underwear, to keep her children from stealing her money. And I'm talking about adult children.
Mm-hmm.
When I met her, Rosalie's youngest child in 88 was in her late 20s, the eighth born child. And so all the children were adults. And all of them, all six of them, the four boys and the two girls who were drug addicts, would steal money from her for their own drug habits. And there was always conflict over the money. Rosalie would spend a lot of time when she got the check going to the supermarket and filling the house with food, filling the refrigerator with food. And then 2 and 3 days later, the house would be empty of any food because the food, particularly the frozen meats, would be sold by the children in order to get drugs.
Leon Dash is a reporter for The Washington Post. His new book is called Rosalie, A Mother and Her Family in Urban America. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the isolation of people in America's underclass. We continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Leon Dash. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Leon Dash. He spent much of his career writing about the growth of the black underclass and the connections among racism, poverty, illiteracy, drugs, and crime. His new book, Rosalie, is based on his Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles in the Washington Post about one woman and her family, a case study of life in the underclass. You know, it's interesting to me, Rosalie was illiterate. And when you were telling her about your education and about your parents and the jobs they had, and your father was, I think, a supervisor in the post office, your mother worked for the New York City Health Department, she was shocked that black people could have jobs like that, that African Americans were allowed to have jobs like that. When you told her about your education, her attitude was, well, I never really thought education was important, so when my kids wanted to sleep instead of go to school, that was fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
What did that make you think about?
Her isolation. She was totally isolated from mainstream American life. What little she noticed of it was usually on television. She rarely went to, almost never went to the movies. She did go to the movies as a child, but not as an adult. She did not understand her comment about voting and not voting. I remember during the campaign and when Clinton was being inaugurated, in January of 93, we were sitting in her house in her living room, and the inauguration was on the television, but we were discussing Patty and her latest arrest and incarceration in connection with a brutal murder.
Patty, her oldest daughter.
Her oldest daughter, right. And I said to her, I mentioned to her that Clinton was being inaugurated, and she said to me, well, who is he and where is he from? And it was just—it was astounding to me that that's how, even at that late date. Now, I had known her at that point 5 years. Now, this is 5 years after I met her. Just how isolated she was. I said, "Well, that's the new president. He was elected in November in the general election, and he's taking the oath of office." And she said, "Where's he from?" And I said, "He's from Arkansas." She said, "Oh, no! They haven't elected some man from Arkansas. Oh, we're in trouble now." And I said to her, I said, "Well, Rosalie, have you ever voted?" And she said, "No, I never intend to vote. I never will vote. It won't make one bit of difference in my life." And I said, "Well, why do you feel that way?" And she said, "Well, the only thing that's changed for us is that we no longer have to ride in the back of the bus. But nothing else has changed for us." And I said, "Rose, there's been a tremendous expansion of opportunities, particularly since the 60s. And she said, "Well, that's what you think, and that's what these people run around saying, but I haven't seen it." So she was totally unaware of any change in the American political or social spectrum. And here she was in 1992. She was 55 years old and didn't see that there had been any change. And that, in my interrelationship with her, the six of her children that were drug addicted and were criminal or are criminal recidivists, that same level of isolation was very, very prevalent.
Now, Rosalie had eight children. Six of them remained in the underclass.
Right.
Two of them got decent jobs, have their own homes,
mm-hmm.
And rejected drugs, rejected crime, never tried drugs,
mm-hmm.
and didn't like the idea of shoplifting at all. Any explanation there for...
Well, whatever happened to both of them happened while they were in elementary school, while they were very young.
Mm-hmm.
For Alvin is the oldest of the two who didn't end up in the underclass. Alvin and Eric, the two boys. Alvin developed a sense of shame and humiliation about living on welfare because the children at his school who were better off, who lived in private homes rather than in public housing, would tease him about the fact that he was so poor and that he did live on welfare, that his clothes were so raggedy and his shoes so holy. And so he developed a sense of shame about it. He was embarrassed by the welfare truck, food truck, which this is in the days before food stamps, that would come by once a month and deliver surplus federal food to those who were welfare poor. And he felt a deep sense, such a deep sense of shame about that, that he wouldn't go out to the welfare truck when Rosalie would send her children out to get the family's allotment, because he didn't want to be seen carrying burlap bags full of surplus food because it identified you as welfare poor. For Eric, Eric developed the same sense of anger and disgust with his mother, directed at his mother, when he became aware, also in elementary school, that his mother was stealing and shoplifting, and that most of the clothes that he and his siblings wore were stolen by his mother. And he confronted her as a young child, elementary school child, in the second or third grade. He confronted his mother and said to her, the kids at the school are teasing me about you stealing. And do you steal a lot? And she told him quite bluntly, yes, I steal. I steal to make sure that all of you have some clothes on your back. And he said, well, you get a check for us. How come you have to steal? And she said to him, well, the check is not enough to feed and clothe all eight of you. And he still didn't understand that. He said if as a child, he said he was looking at his mother and he was saying, well, if you get a check, I don't understand why you have to steal. And in other words, I don't understand why I have to go through this humiliation about you stealing when you get a check. Well, that kind of reaction, shame and humiliation on the part of Alvin, anger and disgust on the part of Eric, carried them into their adolescence. And luckily, they were receptive enough to gravitate toward two mentors. For Alvin, it was his eighth grade junior high school teacher, a man named Gautrell Franklin. And for Eric, it was a social worker that was involved with the family, Nancy McAllister. And then those two individuals, those two adults, ended up mentoring Alvin and Eric for the next 20 years.
Now, both of those sons who got out of the underclass did some time in the military. How important do you think the military was to their ability to get out of the underclass?
Not at all. I don't
think
it was.
Interesting. Bobby
went into the underclass. Bobby went into the military. He was the first. They were following Bobby, their oldest brother.
Mm-hmm.
But Bobby had also begun burglarizing houses at the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his mother, Rosalie, instructed him as he was stealing and getting arrested quite often, to use the name Cunningham, which was her married name. She married the father of her third child, Alvin. But Bobby's legal name was Wright. And she said, well, use Cunningham when you get arrested. And he did. So he's got a 5-year juvenile stretch of criminal arrest and convictions and incarceration as a juvenile under the name Robert Cunningham. But when he went to apply to join the military, he did so under the name Robert Wright, which was his legal name. And what was his motivation in joining the military? He wanted to go to Vietnam so he could get into drug dealing. He was told that you could make money in Vietnam dealing drugs. So he was in the military. Alvin and Eric had a different motivation in joining the military. Alvin joined the military because by this time he was a teenage father. He had dropped out of high school. He was going to night school, and he didn't think that the teachers there were motivated in teaching them. He lied about his age and got a job working general labor in construction for a couple of years. And then he joined the military, got his GED at a Kansas army base, married the mother of his daughter, and the two of them went off into the service. But Alvin had already determined what kind of life he was going to live before he joined the military.
But did the military help him get what he wanted?
It did, in terms of providing him with the GED, because mm-hmm. then he took college courses after he got out of the military. But Alvin was made before he joined the military.
Right.
The people think that you can turn somebody around at 18. I don't think from what I've been looking at over the last 12 years that it occurs that late.
But for somebody who was motivated, the Army helped provide opportunity. Is that fair to say?
Well, Bobby was motivated to become a drug dealer.
Right.
That's why he joined the Army. I mean, he wanted to go to Vietnam because he understood that the heroin in Vietnam was very cheap. He could try to arrange some situation to ship it to the States and sell that heroin that he was buying in Vietnam in the United States. For Eric, it didn't work out that well for Eric. One thing, 5 of Rosalie's 8 children are illiterate, although all of them born in Washington, D.C., all attending public schools in Washington, D.C., and Eric is one of them.
I'm wondering,
the Army wasn't able to overcome that for Eric. Well, that's the only point I wanted to make.
Yeah. Right. My guest is Leon Dash. His new book, Rosalie, is a case study of life in the underclass. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leon Dash, and a couple of years ago he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Washington Post about a 51-year-old woman named Rosalie and her family. That series has been expanded into a new book called Rosalie. I'm interested in hearing how the story of Rosalie affected your understanding of the underclass. And, you know, as you say in the book, there's something in her story to back up any political point of view, liberal, moderate, conservative. You can use her story as an example of how she was victimized, or use her story as an example of how she was responsible for her own fate.
Exactly, which is what I expect people to do who come and to reading it with their own presumptions and political biases, which we all have. The greatest thing for me in learning about Rosalie and her family, and looking at the role of her parents and her grandparents, and what happened subsequently to Rosalie's children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, was how poverty is passed on from generation to generation because of deficiencies that are historical. Her mother, here now in Washington, D.C., in the 1930s and early 40s, raised Rosalie as if they were still living in the rural South. And she explained to Rosalie, Rosalie was raised to take care of all of her younger brothers and sisters, to do all the house cleaning while her mother worked as a domestic worker in Washington, and cook all the food and so on, by the time she was 5 and 6, because the rural Southern tradition in black families was that by the age of 8, a young girl should be able to take care of all of the household tasks that are required of an adult woman. And if she wasn't able to do that, then there was something wrong with her, because by the age of 9, she was generally sent out to work in better-off white homes to work as a domestic worker. Rosalie rebelled against being raised like this and complained to her mother that she didn't understand why her mother was putting all of these household chores on her, why she had to do all the, why she even had to chop the wood to heat the water to wash the clothes. And her mother said, because this is the only kind of work we can find for black people, and this is what you'll have to do. And Rosalie decided that she was not going to do that. But at the other end, she wasn't given the kind of academic education that would allow her to enter the mainstream American job market.
So she started stealing as a teenager.
Very early.
Rosalie and her 6 children who remained in the underclass, did they ever work? Did they ever have legit jobs? And what was their attitude toward trying to get jobs?
Well, Rosalie has a son who's worked as a cook, Ronnie, and been a heroin and crack addict since he moved back to Washington in 1990 after he got out of jail in Puerto Rico for dealing heroin in Puerto Rico. But he has always worked as a cook, and he's been a heroin addict since he was 15. Mm-hmm. He is now in his mid-40s, and he's living right today in an abandoned house in Southeast Washington and working at a restaurant in suburban Maryland.
Hmm. And what about the others?
Ducky worked as Rosalie's youngest son, who was also a crack addict. He worked for a time as a security guard, but then was fired for firing his gun at some kids who were stealing bread off of Wonder Bread trucks. And Wonder Bread thought that was an excessive overkill in terms of his reaction to the kids stealing bread, that he was firing his .38 revolver at them. And he has never had a legitimate job since. Always been involved in dealing crack and burglarizing houses.
Rosalie ever work or try to get a job?
Yeah, several places she worked. Generally, she worked at places that were paying her very low wages in cash because she was off the clock. She worked at 4 different places and received cash, legitimate income. But she wasn't working even, they weren't even paying her at the federal standard for pay. The hourly wage.
Do you see Rosalie as being a victim or as being responsible for her own inability to get out of the underclass?
She was both responsible for the bad choices that she made. I mean, the prostitution of her daughter, 11-year-old daughter, was a horrible choice that she made. And many other choices that she made were bad choices. Bad choices over... She was able, in the early 50s, to get blue-collar employment, even though she was illiterate. And she would all work as a domestic, because her mother had trained her well in that. And she rejected that. What happened to her was foreordained in that she was sort of, because of the history of racial segregation and discrimination against blacks that had limited her parents and her grandparents, that also ended up limiting Rosalie.
Some of Rosalie's story conforms to some of the worst stereotypes of the underclass. For example, on the day that welfare checks come, that's the day all the drug dealers show up to collect old debts and to sell new drugs. Now, a lot of people who oppose welfare say one of the reasons why we oppose it is that people just use it to buy drugs. So I'm wondering how her story affected your personal feelings about welfare.
Well, the business about drug dealers running around collecting money on the day the welfare checks arrive is not a stereotype. That's an accurate and it's a real occurrence. The unfortunate thing is that there is a lot of people get involved in drugs because they see drugs as an opportunity, as Rosalie did. She dealt drugs, as I mentioned, for 19 years before she ever used any. And the young people today see drugs as an opportunity, particularly crack cocaine. And now in Washington, marijuana has made a big comeback among a generation that's trying to avoid crack addiction. But the involvement with the drugs is always seen as an economic opportunity. And as long as you're going to have poverty as deep as you do in urban cities, you're going to have children who enter the drug trade seeking opportunity.
So getting back to welfare, did Rosalie's story change your opinion about welfare in any way?
No, welfare, only about 30% of the people who are on welfare are people who are dependent on welfare. The 70% generally move in and off of welfare within 2 years of being on welfare. People think that Rosalie and people like her are the majority of people on welfare, and they're not. If you look at the statistics, most of the people on welfare use welfare as it was intended when it was first put through by the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration in the 1930s as a response to the deprivations caused by the Great Depression. So it hasn't changed my mind about welfare at all.
So you still think it's important? And
well, I think it's a safety net. And my apprehension is that the new welfare law, I don't call it welfare reform, but the new federal welfare law is going to remove what little safety net has been instituted, and you're going to see more children entering the underclass because they're going to be deprived of whatever little safety net the welfare has provided over the last 60 years.
Now, Rosalie had 6 children who remained in the underclass, 2 children who got out of it. The 2 children who got out of it could form a compelling argument for the value of self-help. These 2 kids were motivated to reject crime, to reject drugs. They stayed on that motivated path. They got jobs, they got homes, they got out of the underclass. Therefore, other people, if they're motivated, can do it too. It's their own responsibility. What would you say?
Well, I don't know how you put the responsibility on children. Both Alvin and Eric had responses as young children to welfare and to the circumstances of crime in their household, and led them to reject both welfare or living on welfare, and being involved in any sort of crime at very early ages. I don't know how you put that responsibility on children of elementary school level. I suspect you cannot. A lot of adults probably would. A lot of adults treat children as if they are adults in talking about their behavior, even as adolescents. But they're still children emotionally, mm-hmm. and they don't have the adult concrete thinking pattern yet, of which says that if I do this today, then this is the long-term consequence. That's adult thinking. Adolescents nor children have that kind of thinking.
Your series about Rosalie ran a Pulitzer Prize in 1995 after running in the Washington Post. Now the series has been expanded into a book. You say when the series ran on the Washington Post, there were a lot of middle-class African-Americans who were who complained about the series, saying that it reinforced stereotypes of African-Americans. And I'm interested in hearing your response to
that. Well, that's a predictable complaint. They did the same kind of complaining when I did the series on adolescent childbearing. Middle-class blacks, a significant number of them, tend to look at themselves through the eyes of whites and do not want any negative stories that talk about the reality of poverty and the decisions people who are trapped in poverty make to live day to day, because they feel that the entire society will see this as genetic behavior rather than behavior that grows out of the circumstances of poverty and a long history of racial oppression. I understand the reaction. I disagree with it.
And why do you disagree with it?
I don't think that we should look at ourselves through the eyes of whites.
Are you going to continue to tell the stories of people in the underclass?
Yes. Why? My next project is adolescent violence.
Why is this an almost lifelong pursuit of yours?
I think it needs to be revealed and laid out in all of its pain and reality, in the most graphic way that I can.
Leon Dash, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
Leon Dash writes for The Washington Post. His new book is called Rosalie. Coming up, a preview of the new TV season. This is Fresh Air. The new fall TV season begins tonight, and TV critic David Bianculli is ready to guide us through the first week. Here's his rundown on which shows to sample and which to avoid.
Let's do it one night at a time. Tonight, the new shows worth checking out are Cosby and Pearl on CBS. I've seen 3 episodes of Bill Cosby's new sitcom, and they work nicely. Cosby and Felicia Rashad are as good together as ever, Madeline Kahn gives very funny support, and there aren't any little kids around to hog the spotlight. Then there's Pearl, the show that has Rhea Perlman of Cheers as a woman realizing her dream of finally attending college. She's very likable here, but the show's secret weapon is Malcolm McDowell, who plays her humanities teacher. He's as tough as John Houseman's Professor Kingsfield was in The Paper Chase, and McDowell is just great. Who would have thought that the juvenile delinquent of A Clockwork Orange and If would grow up to be such a figure of authority? I guarantee you, next year's Emmys will have McDowell as a nominee.
Let me tell you about my favorite subject, me. Born in Glasgow, raised in poverty, Oxford educated. Divorced from a woman who enjoyed introducing me as her bitter half. Published 12 times and fully tenured. Like most self-made men, I am in awe of my creator. I've been accused of being acerbic, sarcastic, egomaniacal, insensitive, sardonic, domineering, and cruel. Well, I don't think I'm cruel. Life is about surviving. deal with me, survive this class, and you'll be able to swim in the shark-infested waters of the corporate world. Handle French maitre d's, plumbers, cab drivers. And maybe even hold your own with those awful little men who install telephones.
On Tuesday, the two new shows to try this week are Something So Right on NBC and Spin City on ABC. Both of them are very smart comedies. Something So Right stars Mel Harris of 30-something and Jerry Burns of Dear John as the heads of a kind of Brady Bunch household of the 90s. Spin City, one of the most polished pilots of the season, stars Michael J. Fox as the deputy mayor of New York City. The cast, the lines, the premise, everything about Spin City is just right out of the box. Wednesday, the show worth sampling, believe it or not, is Men Behaving Badly. This series has the same kind of freshness about it that Third Rock from the Sun had last year. It's weird and it's different, and so is Rob Snyder from Saturday Night Live, whose cartoonish style of acting may actually make Men Behaving Badly a surprise hit for NBC. Thursday, you may as well check out Brooke Shields in Suddenly Susan, because everybody else will. The final reworked pilot isn't all that impressive, but in his time slot against Seinfeld and ER, it doesn't have to be. The bigger Thursday news, though, is that this week both Friends and Seinfeld are serving up season premieres. Similarly, on Friday, the biggest news is that Homicide: Life on the Street begins a new season, getting a much earlier start than usual. And on the weekend, the one new series worth trying out, I guess, is Dark Skies, the Aliens in the 60s show that NBC has promoted about 100,000 times. I expected it to be a lot better, but I expected that of the movie Independence Day, too, and that seemed to do all right. What to avoid? In general, almost everything else. In particular, Love and Marriage this Saturday on Fox, because it gets my vote as the worst new show of the season. The week's very best, Pearl tonight and Spin City tomorrow.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Barbara Bogave and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steve Martin about comedy, movies, plays, and paintings. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.